Welcome to Tokyo Game Life, a Tokyo-based video game podcast focusing on Nintendo and gaming culture in Japan's capital. As always, I'm your host, Mono. We are on the verge of Sakura season in Tokyo. Both Sakura and Koyo, or fall leaves, are very important leaf-related events in Tokyo and Japan in general. If you want to see Sakura at their peak, at their full bloom, at their mankai in Japanese, you really got to follow the news and time your trips accordingly. They're really at their most beautiful for only a few days, if that. There's a lot of great Sakura spots in Tokyo, Ueno Park, Meguro, and even some places a little bit outside the city like Kawagoe are really nice. I gotta admit, I'm jealous of Kansai because they have a lot of amazing Sakura spots. But this is not a Sakura podcast, it's a video game one. And outside of Sakura, there's plenty of other things to experience in Tokyo, like the Tokyo Game Music Show, a music event featuring many incredible Japanese video game composers. I'll be joined by the ultra-healthy video game nerd who attended the event. We'll hear his thoughts and just chat about some great Japanese game music. Turns out there's a lot of it. And yeah, there's quite a number of huge games hitting in March. I'll be talking about Triangle Strategy, the newest HD 2D strategy RPG from Square Enix. I won't be as verbose as the characters in that game, but I'll do my best. Then I'll give my thoughts on Elden Ring, the massive epic from Software. And as a palate cleanser from all that medieval mayhem, I played Cruisin' Blast earlier this year, and I definitely think it's worth chatting about. I mean, you can't drive a UFO in Elden Ring. And as always, I'll run down the news, including, yes, Pokemon. Everyone's given their hot takes on Pokemon Scarlet and Violet, but now it's my turn. I thought that since I'm done with Arceus, maybe the Pokemon talk would slow down on the podcast, but nope, it's come back with a vengeance. So get ready for another great episode. Let's jump right into the feature on the Tokyo Game Music Show. This episode's feature is all about the Tokyo Game Music Show, a yearly event featuring Japanese video game composers. I didn't attend the event, but fortunately I'm joined by a guest who can tell us all about it. So guest, could you please introduce yourself?
Hi, thanks for having me on. Yes, my name's Chris. A lot of people know me as Ultra Healthy Video Game Nerd on YouTube and social media. I used to make videos covering very little known retro games in Japan. And now I'm kind of just doing my thing here in Japan. And I did get to go to the Tokyo Game Music Show yesterday, and it was a blast.
Thanks for joining me today. So for those who have never attended, what is the Tokyo Game Music Show?
The Tokyo Game Music Show is like a comic market, but it's for video game music composers. So, you know, they have booths, they sell their music, their CDs, basically. And a lot of it is CDs that are not released like officially, might not have like serial numbers. In some cases, it's just stuff they've burned onto CDRs. But, you know, you can go and buy stuff from them directly and, you know, you can talk to them and fanboy to them and tell them how much you love their music and that kind of thing.
It's more like Comiket than a music festival, right?
Yeah, definitely. There are a few performances, but I mean, that's kind of exterior. Yeah, it is like Comiket more basically.
When was the first time you attended the event?
I think it was 3 years ago was the first one that I went to. That would have been 2019. It's always around this time of year, either at the end of February or early March. So yeah, the first time I went, I think, was 3 years ago.
When did your interest in Japanese video game music begin?
Quite a long time ago. I think as a kid, I had sort of like subconsciously always enjoyed the music in the games. And then it really started around the time my older brother gave me his Sega Genesis. One of the games in particular was Valis 3 on the Sega Genesis. And like the music was just incredible to me. You know what I'm saying? There were some other games that I was enjoying the music from, but it was like I liked it so much that I would play just to listen to the music. At the time, you know, living in America, those games were published by a sort of company that they had established in America called Renovation. So I sort of started to realize that like any game with this Renovation logo had really good music. And it was kind of later on that I realized the parent company was this Japanese company called Nihon Telenet. But that was just kind of the start of it. And it just kept growing and growing and growing for 25 years until I'm here where I'm at now. But it really all started with the Sega Genesis, kind of with Valis. Yeah, and discovering Nihon Telenet's music and then just kind of expanding from there.
Do you know who the musician or composer for Valis 3 is?
There are several, and they're different across the PC Engine and Sega Genesis version.
Hmm.
So it's like three people. I think the PC Engine version was like maybe Yuasa Minoru, possibly Murakami Shingo might have been one of the people. I think even actually Umezu Takaharu might have been one of the people as well. These are people that are not active anymore, that no one has any connection to at all.
So do you have any favorite Japanese video game composers or musicians?
Absolutely, yes. There's a person named Yuge Masahiro, and he was someone who worked at Toa Plan, which you may have heard of. They made very famous games like Zero Wing and Kyukyoku Tiger. So he wrote the music for Truxton and V5 and Fire Shark and those kind of games. So he's definitely one of my favorite musicians. Tamayo Kawamoto, she wrote the music for the Ray series, so Ray Force, Ray Storm, and Ray Crisis. And before that, she was with Capcom. So she wrote the music for games like Forgotten Worlds, it's called Lost World, the arcade, Ghouls and Ghosts, those kinds of things. And Yamanaka Toshiya is another who, he wrote the music for Star Cruiser. He used to work with a company called Arsys kind of early on. And then he got picked up by Treasure later on. So he did a few soundtracks for them. He did about half the music on Bangayo and then Sin and Punishment. Those really are kind of my holy trinity. Those I can generally say are my three favorite musicians.
Those are some pretty obscure picks. I think a lot of people would probably say Koji Kondo or Nobuo Uematsu. So are you more drawn towards these more unknown video game composers?
The well-known people tend to be famous for doing role-playing game music. That really is the game music that gets kind of, you know, the worldwide, you know, like big sales, you know, huge budget kind of stuff. And I personally am not really very interested in orchestral sounding music, like symphonic style music. So yeah, I mean, There is definitely music I enjoy by, you know, Nobuo Uematsu and that kind of stuff. But yeah, no, my favorite game music composers really, you know, they write music that's more kind of like progressive rock maybe, or, you know, hard to, you know, stick into a genre, you know, arcade music.
A lot of developers seem to have these internal house bands like Zuntata for Taito, and Capcom also had Alf Lila. Why do you think this system is so prevalent among Japanese game developers?
I don't know how that came along, but it was a thing in like the late 80s and early 90s. You know, heaven only knows how that started, but it just became just this like popular phenomenon for an arcade developer to have their in-house band, right? I know. And there's maybe five or six main ones. You could say Taito had Zuntata, Capcom had Alf Lyra, Konami had Kukeha Club, Data East had Gamedelic, Sega had SST Band, Supersonic Team. And SNK a bit later then had Shinsekai Gakkyoku Zatsugidan, which is hard to translate. I often think of it as being New World Musical Acrobats. And then Falcom had their sound team, of course. It's hard to say. I think at the time, it was sort of like the composers, you know, they were writing music for the arcades, which was, you know, it's limited, right, by the technology, by the hardware. But I think in their minds, they were writing, you know, music that was supposed to be like rock music to an extent. So it kind of made sense to then like have arranged versions of the music where maybe you could hear something that was a little bit more like the composer's original intention. They were releasing game soundtracks. Generally, one single game at the time really often didn't have enough music to, you know, fill up a full CD. You know, even if you loop things twice, it might only be 20 minutes of music. It would make sense to have a couple arranged versions. So that could have been, I think, part of the reason why that started.
So back to the Tokyo Game Music Show. Who are some of the exhibitors that appeared this year?
This year, some names that people might recognize are Iwadare Noriyuki. He's a pretty famous guy. Zuntata canceled, unfortunately. They weren't there. Watanabe Yasuhisa was there finally. I think he's had to cancel a couple times in the past for health reasons, but he was there. He's done a lot of famous music. He wrote the music for things like Border Down, Elevator Action Returns, Senko no Ronde, those kinds of games. Abo Takeshi was there. He's a very prolific guy. I think he does Phantom Breaker. A group called Beta Flash, which consists of the musician that I mentioned, Tamayo Kawamoto, and then she writes music for this the vocalist. So they call themselves Beta Flash when they work together. They're always there. Oh, and Yona Okeishi. He's a pretty big guy. And then there were a couple of people who didn't have booths, but were just there as kind of participants. So Technouchi was there. He's a pretty recognizable name. And for the first time, Otani Tomomi. Now, this is not somebody who's done like a whole lot of video game music, but some people might recognize him. He worked for Technosoft. So he wrote the soundtracks to Thunder Force 2 and Herzog's Way and parts of Thunder Force 3. So I finally got to meet him for the first time.
Were there any notable items that you purchased this year or something that caught your eye?
There was some things that I expected, but I got this. There was one thing I bought that was totally unexpected and amazing. So there's a shooting game called Akato Blue. I think it might have even been developed by ex-Cave employees. The composer, the original composer, this guy named Wasi303, he was there. And he's got CDs of the game music that he writes, but he downgrades it to like older console-based sounds. So I discovered that he had created a PC Engine versions of the music to Akato Blue. And I had no idea. And not only, you know, he's a full-length CD, it's every song. At the place, he had a real PC Engine set up, and like they built some kind of like device where you put it in the card slot, but then you can run out MIDI sound from it. So you could sample the music running through an actual PC Engine hardware's sound hardware. It was crazy.
So the Tokyo Game Music Show also has stage shows. What are these stage shows like?
They'll have some people perform music. They'll have some talk shows also, actually. They'll just, you know, have some game musicians just, you know, talking or being interviewed and that too. But there are some performances. I think this year they were actually finally able to do some performances. It's been hard to do because of Corona. Gamedelic performed. So Gamedelic is sort of like reformed. Kind of said that this was something, from a long time ago. But Gamedelic has been active again. So they did perform. Unfortunately, I had work in the morning and it turned out they were the first ones. So I didn't make it in time to hear them. But I did get their new CDs, so that was fine. And Betaflash performed, which is mostly synth, but the girl singing live. But yeah, they can have instruments. They can have bands up, you know, I think if they try.
Is it a bit intimidating to meet and chat with these musicians, especially in Japanese?
For me personally, yes, it is. It's definitely sort of intimidating. Right? I get nervous when I meet people who I, you know, really respect like this. This is something I've been passionate about for, you know, a good 25 years, but I've gotten a bit more comfortable. I think this year, I probably had some of the longest conversations I've ever had, I think. And, you know, I mean, it's not anywhere near as large scale as Comic Market. You really can, you know, just stand there and chat with these people for a while, and you're not getting in the way of others. As far as speaking in Japanese, I've been living in Japan for 17 years. I moved here in 2005, and I had minored in Japanese before I moved to Japan. So I'm very fluent in Japanese. That's not really a problem. Just sort of as a psychological thing of like, being in reverence, you know, of these people sometimes, like, you know, trying to convey that without sounding like a crazy person. It can be intimidating.
Do you have any recommendations for icebreakers when talking to a musician you're a fan of?
I go up to them, I say, you know, hi, nice to meet you. I'm a big fan of the music in such and such game, and, you know, I really respect your work. At the very least, they'll say, thank you very much. That's wonderful. And if you're lucky, they themselves might then start up a conversation with you.
Is there anybody who you didn't really know a whole lot about, but you learned more about during the Tokyo Game Music Show?
Yes, I did actually kind of meet this one guy. So there's a person who runs a company called Mindware. I had never really like known a whole lot about them, but apparently this guy has been around for a very long time. The president is this person named Mr. Ichikawa. Some people who pay more attention to like developer names might know who this is. I think he's probably a pretty well-known person. So yeah, he talked my head off. We actually probably talked for a good half hour or so. And he's made some, you know, retro stylized games. Turns out, and I had heard this news like somehow on my Twitter feed, and I was just like, that's crazy. He's trying to develop a sequel to a game called Slap Fight. Slap Fight is a very early shooter by Toa Plan. There was a Sega Genesis or Sega Mega Drive conversion in Japan only. It's a game I have. It's a relatively expensive game. And I had seen this news on Twitter that like someone was trying to like make a new Slap Fight game. I didn't even know what to think of that. But anyways, I met this person and it turned out it was him. And he was like, yeah, like we're going to be doing like crowdfunding like really soon. Like it's like super close. he's had to work together with, you know, the former Toa Plan employees to get the, you know, the rights and everything. But he was telling me all these crazy stories, because he's, you know, been doing this probably for 30 years. He was telling me this story of this person who made the person who developed Doshin the Giant on the, maybe was that the Nintendo 64 disk drive or something?
Yes, the disk drive.
Yeah, so apparently there's this game that same person made. It's a PlayStation 2 game called Ingot. Like a gold ingot. Have you ever heard of this?
I don't think I've personally heard of it, but what is it?
So I've been living here for ages. I've never even heard of it. Now, apparently, he was telling me that it was Mitsubishi Materials had, like, apparently gotten some contracts to excavate, like, gold veins in maybe South America or something like this. And so they wanted to commission somebody to make a game to kind of, like, promote this new business they were doing. So this guy made this game called Ingot, and somehow they ended up working with this person, who had made Doshin the Giant, and he made this game called Ingot. And so, like, it didn't sell, like, at all. Like, it was like a horrible, horrible commercial failure, apparently. But this dude, Mr. Ichikawa, he's telling me it's a brilliant game, and, like, nobody gives it any props, and, like, no one cares, but it's, like, totally weird, like, genius game. So it's probably dirt cheap. So I think I'm going to give it a try.
It's either extremely cheap or extremely expensive, is my guess.
Right. No one cares, or it's $500. Yeah.
Is there anyone you hope shows up in the future at the Tokyo Game Music Show?
I was hoping, I would really like to meet Yamanaka Toshiya. He's one of my big three composers that I really love that I've never met in person. And he has participated in these artist CDs called FM Vertex. Recently, the person Yonao Keishi, he's put together these compilation CDs called FM Vertex with, like, one song composed in FM by a bunch of famous game musicians. So he just released the second one. Just came out, and he's gotten Yamanaka Toshiya to do a song on both of them. So I actually mailed Mr. Yonao on Twitter and asked, hey, like, it looks like you've been working with Mr. Yamanaka. Is there any way you could ask him to come to Tokyo Game Music Show? So he responded to me, and he told me that he asked him too, but he kind of lives far away, and maybe his health hasn't been so good. You know, these are people who are getting old. They've been doing music for a very long time. So I would love to see him. There's someone else who I'd really think it would be awesome if it was there. And he hasn't done a lot of video game music, but there are a couple games called Zero Divide 1 and 2. They're kind of early polygonal fighting games. Mm-hmm. And the music was written by this person, Mr. Ota. I can't remember the first name. Maybe it's Akifumi or something like that. But the music is incredible. It's, like, totally out there. I've made exchanges with him very briefly on Facebook. And he told me that, like, really, like, writing music is not his primary job. That mostly, I think he, like, makes sound hardware, which would make sense because the sound quality, it was, like, very, like, you know, analog synth. It was, like, very, very high quality at the time. I think it would be amazing to meet him and maybe even to hear some more music from him, because those are incredible soundtracks.
So Japan will hopefully open up for tourism in 2023. So would you recommend Japanese game music fans attend the Tokyo Game Music Show in the future?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, check the roster of who's going to be there. You know, it's generally a relatively small scale event. You know, it's not, you know, like shoulder to shoulder people like Comic Market is, you know, and yeah, you can, you know, meet some of these composers up close and personal. And it's really awesome. I definitely think it's a good reason to come visit. She wasn't there this year, but for example, Naruke Michiko is often there. She writes the music to Wild Arms, so probably a lot of big fans of her music. I have seen Kikuta Hiroki there in the past, you know, the person who did, like, you know, Secret of Mana and those games. So, you know, there's some really big name people, and there's some more obscure people too who I'm not really acquainted with, but have their own following.
Excellent. So where can people find you if they want to get in touch with you?
People can find me. I think the easiest way is on Twitter. My Twitter account is still called Ultra Healthy Video Game Nerd. So I'm there and relatively active. My DMs are open. You know, I don't really make videos anymore, but the YouTube channel is still around. So yeah, I think Twitter is the easiest way.
And listeners, I'll be providing links to Ultra Healthy Video Game Nerd in the podcast description, so please be sure to check it out. Ultra Healthy Video Game Nerd, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks a lot, too. I really appreciate it, man. Had a fun time.
Again, thank you to Ultra Healthy Video Game Nerd. I've linked to his Twitter account in the podcast description, so be sure to follow him. Let's dig into some new games. First up is Triangle Strategy, a new strategy RPG from Square Enix and Art Dink. It's helmed by Tomoyo Asano, who also worked on the Bravely series and Octopath Traveler. You've probably heard of Square Enix, but Art Dink is a bit more unknown. They are most known for the A-Resha, or A-Train series. It's a train management sim game. There's actually one on Switch. They've co-developed and done support work for a ton of games. Nobody Can Stop Mr. Domino? They're responsible for his unstoppability. Tale of the Sun is another one of their games. They've also worked on ports of Ogre Battle and Tactics Ogre, which is more in line with the work they've done on this game. Like Square Enix, Art Dink is based in Tokyo. Their office is in Tsukishima, which is famous for Monjiaki. Monjiaki is a very typical Tokyo-style food, but come on, we gotta admit that Okonomiyaki is way better. Triangle Strategy is not quite Final Fantasy Tactics and not quite Fire Emblem. Triangle Strategy obviously borrows a ton from these franchises, but it does manage to separate itself in a few notable ways. The first thing that comes to mind is that it feels a lot more streamlined than those titles. Both FFT and Fire Emblem have a heavy emphasis on customization, on min-maxing, on equipment builds. But Triangle Strategy forgoes most of that. You don't create your own characters like in FFT, and you don't play around with switching up classes for established characters like in FE. Characters have very linear growths. You hit level 10, you can upgrade to a single class that is just a super version of the one you're already rocking. Spy turns into Assassin, for instance. Weapons work the same way. You don't switch out or equip weapons, but instead just improve the ranking of the one you already have. Each ranking has a sort of skill tree where you can choose some bonus stat that applies to your character, like adding more attack or adding more health. This sort of linear growth might turn some people off, especially since tactics RPGs typically revolve around a great deal of customization, but Triangle Strategy does have some interesting customization options. It relies far more on unique characters that do specific things, opposed to more well-rounded, jack-of-all-trades type of folks. A lot of the early characters are your typical SRPG classes. You have a swordsman, a cavalry, a healer, a tank, a thief-slash-rogue type of character. But then as your roster grows, it gets much more particular. Magic is split up. You have a fire mage, you have an ice mage, and their attack can affect the field in interesting ways. For example, you can freeze the field to make characters slower, but if you use a fire attack, it'll melt the ice to water, and then you can use an electricity attack on the water for extra damage. Other characters can also do things like set up traps, or help fulfill action points, or even convert an enemy to your side. Every time I get a new character, I'm curious to see how they gel with the team in battle. Many of them are very situational, and I can see some people wanting to stick with the more traditional classes, but the game does a great job in making everyone seem completely unique. People don't have overlaps when it comes to abilities either. I have two characters who can use fire magic, but their skill set is completely different. Battles turn into fun experiments, and you're likely to discover some interesting combos and team synergies. The game also relies more heavily on special attacks. Again, with the streamlining, characters don't have MP, so no blue bar. Instead, they have 3 or 4 TP. There's a default attack, of course, but characters have several abilities that cost TP. A character's TP refills 1 point per turn, so you do need to think carefully about when to break out a move that costs 2 or 3 TP, since it would take several turns before you can use it again. Many abilities cost 1 TP though, meaning you could consistently use them every turn. This means the game relies less on default attacks and more on your abilities, which is a good thing as it keeps battles more strategic. I think in general RPGs have been trying to get away from mindlessly mashing the default attack button and want to make players think a bit more before they act. Many of the abilities are pretty creative. Anna has an ability that turns her invisible, which yeah, is pretty useful, right? She can also act twice per turn, which makes her a very fun unit. Even within one character, the abilities are diverse and useful for specific situations, so it's not like every character has some super attack that you use every turn. So while the game's customization is more linear, it still conveys a sense that you are building a team with its own set of particular strengths. You'll have your favorite characters that you want to send out each time, and you might be surprised about how useful some of the more unorthodox characters can be. The actual battles are pretty much what you would expect from an SRPG. There's a grid, there's enemies. Sometimes your goal is to wipe out everyone. Sometimes you have a very specific requirement, like to move to some specific space. I've noticed that they're more compact, FFT-style maps, instead of these sprawling ones you see in Fire Emblem. A lot of the battles have been inside cities, but they might get more expansive down the line. The UI is pretty intuitive. It's easy to understand where you can move and who you can attack. One thing I like is that when you use an AoE ability, it automatically snaps to the recommended unit. Like if you pick a heal ability, its range might cover 8 characters, but it will auto-lock onto a character with the lowest HP. And if you have an attack that functions the same way, it will lock onto the one who you can damage the most. A lot of these great usability features help keep battles really quick. I've been focusing a lot on the battle mechanics, but a huge bulk of the gameplay is the story. Triangle Strategy is a narrative-heavy game, so much to the point that it's been compared to visual novels. Yes, there's that much text, that many scenes, that much exposition. In the first 2 hours, I had 2 battles that maybe took about 20 minutes total. Once you get to Chapter 3, you start to have more options, and you can do training mock battles that aren't connected to the story and let you grind up levels and try new characters. But at first, the story can be very overwhelming as it throws seemingly dozens of characters at you with very little context. The first chapter is especially bad about this. You transition into cutscenes or battles by selecting a node on the map. The red nodes are story points, and the green nodes are optional side stories. Think of them as short cutscenes that flesh out the world and other characters not in your party. A green node in Chapter 1 is solely about a bunch of people who you've never met, never heard of, just marching in while someone spouts off who is who. Apparently, the writers haven't heard about show, don't tell. However, once the game starts to narrow in on characters that actually relate to your party, the story does get much more interesting. It's based around the aftermath of a conflict known as the Salt Iron War. Nations fought over salt and, you guessed it, iron. Mostly salt, though. Although there is magic and fireballs in this game, it's actually very grounded. The major conflict of the game is really based around resource scarcity, which is not something you see in a typical JRPG. If there is a conflict surrounding a resource, it's typically something like a made-up magic crystal. But here the game really focuses on why salt is so important for medieval societies, namely food preservation. One country is really upset because of unfair taxes around salt. It seems kind of silly at first, because we all take salt for granted, but the game does a good job explaining its importance to the world. Add in the different cultures of each nation, personal ambitions, and you've got yourself a world ripe for war and conflict. Even though the story is very front-loaded at first, it's easy to follow along once it starts to progress. There is also some supplementary material which you can find that gives you backstory on the world, and I really recommend reading it. Though good world building isn't enough, you need to have intriguing characters to help push the story along. Many of the characters definitely fall into some tropes, the idealistic hero, the shy princess, the gruff soldier, stuff like that. But they serve their role in the story, and you start to care about their relationships with each other. While you can spend a lot of time just watching cutscenes play out, you also do some traditional JRPG field exploration. In each chapter, you'll have a chance to control the protagonist and explore a town or area, picking up items and talking to NPCs. The items you get here are actually quite useful. You can find a ton of money, which is vital when it comes to upgrading your character. You also might be prompted with dialogue choices, and that leads into another major part of the game. Your decisions matter. The game is called Triangle Strategy, and the triangle part comes from the 3 concepts the game centers itself around. Utility, morality, and liberty. When you make a dialogue choice, you have 3 options that I guess fall under these 3 concepts. It can be hard to discern at times. I never thought, yes, this is the liberty option. There's typically one that's optimistic, one that's pragmatic, and one that's kind of vague, but it can be a lot more granular than that. When you do something, it will often say your convictions have been strengthened, referring to the triangle concepts. But again, this is very vague. It often says this at random moments. Also, I'm not quite sure about how the choice mechanic actually works. Like, is there a secret utility bar I'm filling up in the background? Should I be focusing all my answers on one concept? It's not like there's a triangle-o-meter that tells you which side you're leaning towards, nor the consequences. It does seem that some characters might lean towards one concept, so you need to pick the choice that lines up with their personality. And this plays a big part into voting, yet another gameplay mechanic. Every now and then, you will need to make a huge story-changing decision. But you can't just pick it by yourself. Here you break out the scales of conviction, and your primary party members vote on the course of action. There are 7 votes, so no ties. Each party member will have their mind made up, and some might be undecided. It's up to you to sway the decision by talking to the party members. For example, the first big decision is where to go, place A or place B. Three wanted A and three wanted B, and one was undecided. I wanted to go to place B, so I talked to the place A party members and tried to convince them. Here you need to carefully decide about your answers to their questions, as failure to do so will result in them keeping their vote. Some of the dialogue options you get during the voting section can only be unlocked by talking to people and discovering information during the town exploration parts, so it's smart how that mechanic also ties in with this one. I'm in Chapter 7, and thus far, there have only been two voting sections. I managed to have the result go in my favor each time, but not everyone came to my side because I lacked info or I didn't pick the right option when convincing them. And these are major decisions with huge ramifications. I mentioned that the first voting section determines where to go. This also determines the next battle, the cutscenes, and even what new people can join your party. These decisions are not to be taken lightly. The second one I won't spoil, and while it may seem easy on the surface, you also have to think about the consequences. I went one way and certainly didn't expect the aftermath. I'm not sure how many endings this game has or how many times you make these big decisions, but it definitely opens up some replay options. Oh, and I should probably mention, this game looks incredible. That seems pretty important. It's HD 2D like Octopath Traveler. It's interesting to see how they try to mimic CRTs in a way by making the pixels not exactly clean, but a bit blurry as to mimic the pixels smearing to create more realistic shadows on CRTs. I will say this works better on a TV than a handheld. The characters do seem a bit abnormally blurry in handheld mode. But either way, I've been taking a lot of screenshots, especially when they get good isometric views of beautiful castles or courtyards, of which there are many. HD2D in general has so much potential. Some have said it looks a bit samey, but Square seems to be experimenting with it more via Live Alive and Dragon Quest III. Final Fantasy VI HD2D is the ultimate dream, but we might be a bit far away from that. Triangle Strategy is really on track to being another excellent Switch exclusive. I can't say it's better than FFT or Three Houses at this point, but even if this game doesn't reach the highs of those two titles, it's still a very solid SRPG. It feels very modernized in many aspects, and while it doesn't have an incredible degree of customization, it stands out with its unique story mechanics and diverse party members. If you want a tactics RPG and don't mind a good, albeit very wordy story, Triangle Strategy should really be on your radar. Alright, we gotta talk about Elden Ring. Now, this is a Nintendo-focused podcast. Keyword is focused, meaning not exclusive. I had to give me some leeway to talk about other games every now and then, and this one is pretty hard to ignore. Elden Ring is the latest Souls-adjacent game from Hidetaki Miyazaki and Tokyo's own From Software. A lot of Tokyo this episode. Although I live here, I often forget that, many games I'm playing were made just a few train stops over. From Software is in Shibuya, but kinda in the outskirts of the ward. So you won't be bumping into their studio when you step out of Shibuya Station. And honestly, there's really no reason to visit any game studio's office in Japan. They're not geared towards tourists, and many of them are in nondescript office buildings. The Square Enix building is pretty cool from the outside, I admit, but still, you don't need to drop by. I feel that before I say one more word about Elden Ring, I need to establish my Souls history so that you can see what perspective I'm coming from. I've played all three Dark Souls games and Sekiro. I highly enjoyed all of them, all would appear on my top 10 list for those respective years, but kinda near the bottom of the top 10, like 7 or 8. These games are so frustrating, so annoyingly obtuse, but I have to admit there is a draw to them, a type of hypnotic allure that I can't ignore. I feel that there's always some way for me to get the upper hand, always some way for me to turn the game systems against itself until I see the credits roll. And seeing all these locales, meeting all these weird people, it's just fun and interesting. It's great to be a tourist in these worlds. I definitely think Souls games are far from perfect though. I don't think these games are flawless and certainly could be improved on many, many aspects. But I can't deny that I get entranced by the Soul Siren more often than not. Now that I've established myself as the greatest Souls player of all time, Elden Ring. From said, what if Dark Souls was open world, and they made that game? From second one, there's no denying this game's DNA. It's a Souls game through and through. If you did not enjoy the past Souls games, it's hard to say that you will enjoy Elden Ring. I do think it's overall less frustrating, as the open world structure allows you to venture off and do different tasks if you get stuck on a particular boss. But you will still have to come back and beat that boss eventually. And honestly, there's no magic sword or upgrade that you're going to find in the open world that will make the boss much more easier. But the fact that the game doesn't hardlock you into one specific area does alleviate a lot of issues some people have had with past Souls games. The open world structure is by far the most important and grandest change they've introduced to the Souls formula. While the complex and labyrinthian dungeons from past Souls games are still present, the majority of the world consists of open fields scattered with hundreds of interesting combat encounters, bespoke areas, and countless things to find. Elden Ring's greatest strength is that it consistently delivers when it comes to discovery. There are so many unpredictable things that aren't in any other open-world game. I found soldiers fighting ghosts, a beach where a giant crab suddenly popped up, a huge walking rock with a castle on top, crystal mines where zombies are using magic to dig up gems. I found a portal that teleported me to a completely different part of the map filled with dragons. Every step seemingly throws you into a new nightmare that is often overwhelming, but always fascinating. If you ride your horse for 30 seconds at full speed, there's guaranteed to be nearly a half dozen strange things you encounter. It's very easy to just completely ignore your goals, ignore enemies even, and just sweep through the vast world searching for the next incredible sight. Everyone's journey is different. I've been talking with people who have been to different places I've never even knew about, despite having the same amount of gameplay hours. It's so fun trading tips about where to go, what useful item to have, and crazy battles we've been caught up in. Souls is kind of like this in general, but Elden Ring takes it many steps further. This isn't merely about turn left down this hallway to find a key item. It's about exploring an entirely different continent and everything that entails. I think it's going to be many months before we learn about everything this game has to offer. Because areas are more open, it allows for a much larger diversity in terms of how you engage with a combat scenario. Stealth is actually viable, and ranged weapons do feel more useful here than in the past. You can really pick and choose who you battle, which is not something you could do in past Souls games. Completely blasting by everyone and just picking up as many items as you can is a viable strategy here, and I feel that the game kind of wants you to do it since you can go anywhere. There have definitely been a few areas where I thought, okay, I'm getting in and getting out. There are more traditional Souls dungeons that are tied into story bosses, and honestly, these are not as exciting as the open world to me. These legacy dungeons are certainly larger than ever, even more maze-like, but that old-school Souls frustration starts to seep in when you gotta clear room after room of enemies that pop up out of nowhere. Let me back on my horse. It is a very particular, handcrafted open world. Every section has meaning. It does not feel copy and pasted like so many other open world games. Yes, there's obviously asset reuse, and some ideas are recycled. Yeah, I've seen the stone imp catacombs. I know that I'm going to get a sacred tear from this church. Even then, From doesn't necessarily play the same card twice, as it tries to diversify everything they reuse in a new way. Like one imp catacomb was centered all around these giant flamethrowers. Another was filled with arrow traps. There's a lot of mining caves, but they have different layouts and things to be aware of. Even though you'll bump into the same enemies every now and then, it is remarkable just how many different creatures and foes they've jammed into this game. There are no real minigames or puzzles. Everything basically revolves around a combat encounter. And that's the bread and butter of Souls. But I think in general, open world games benefit from having diverse things to do in the world. Sorry, I gotta bring it up. Breath of the Wild. The structure of surviving the wild, solving puzzles and shrines to get stronger, then resting and interacting with people at villages is something I'm more drawn towards. Hyrule was a beautiful world that you helped mend. In Elden Ring, you are thrown into a horrific hellscape where you fight for every inch. Can I just say the pots are way more hostile than the marketing led me to believe. I'm not bothering them at all, but if I get anywhere near a singular pot, the mob comes in and it's like Paris from Arceus all over again. Elden Ring and Zelda have different takes on the open world concept, and some people will prefer different things. I could do a 30-minute breakdown of Breath of the Wild versus Elden Ring, but I do think it's unfair towards both games. They are doing very different things and have amazing open worlds, just in different ways. I can't lie though, I do prefer what Zelda was going for. There's no Koroks in Elden Ring, that's a fact. The world is not a character like it is in Zelda. In Elden Ring, if it rains, who cares? In Zelda, it is a life-changing event that alters how you play. Traversal in Elden Ring is pretty static. You have a cool double-jumping horse, but you are not constantly looking for vantage points or being distracted by points of interest right in front of your eyes. In Elden Ring, you discover new interesting areas mostly by pointing yourself to a direction and just going there. You're guaranteed to bump into at least something that is worth your time. Let's talk about rewards. Elden Ring gives you many, many unique items, some useful, some odd, some actually a bit useless. Many have praised the fact that you find so many one-of-a-kind items, but is this actually a good thing? Let's say I do a mini-dungeon, and the reward for clearing it is an axe that doesn't gel with my character build. Yes, this axe is unique, but it's nothing to me. I'm never going to use it. All that dungeon gave me was some souls and the experience of clearing it. Now, the experience is the most important part. In Mario, when you get a shine or a star, you don't necessarily want the actual star. You want the experience of achieving that goal, completing that task. Elden Ring has a ton of challenges that are fun to engage with and complete, but I do feel that the rewards for doing it can be really hit and miss. I think that's just the nature of this type of game, though. Everyone has a different build and playstyle, so they need to accommodate everything. Sorry, another Zelda comparison. In Breath of the Wild, everything you get is absolutely something you are going to use because it is an action game and you are a defined character. So it's easy to put something worthwhile in the world because they know what type of item you want. However, in Elden Ring, I'm a samurai, so there's really only a few very specific things I actually want in terms of making my character stronger. A magic staff isn't it. Neither are crystal bolts or some crafting mat I would never use. And since Elden Ring is so difficult, I feel that most people, myself included, are less likely to be inclined to experiment. People are going to stick with what works. I'm running a Dex Samurai, I'm not going to suddenly become a Strength-heavy tank or a Faith Mage. A lot of the things you receive are actually more side grades than anything. I'm still rocking the default Samurai armor and katana. Yes, I'm getting stronger by buffing up my katana and my health, but it certainly feels less tangible than if I was always changing out my gear for clearly better things. Maybe I'm just a weirdo though, sticking with what I have. But again, when something works, you want to stay with it because even a slight dip in health or damage could result in you losing a boss battle. I honestly would have preferred it if you could not upgrade weapons. Instead, have a larger variety of weapons that are more reliant on stat scaling. Once you start putting in smithing stones into an item, it's hard to turn back. I do feel that while the actual rewards can be hit and miss for me personally, every time I see something, I gotta go get it. The challenge of just obtaining an item is engaging enough for me. And that's why I keep wanting to dive into every cave, every nook and cranny. Yeah, I might not get some super katana in the end, but I want to see what From is crafted, what challenge they dare think could best me. Like other From games, it has an incredible art direction and it's filled with awe-inspiring sights, which really helps push you along in the world. You want to see what crazy thing they thought up next. Sometimes it can feel a bit random. Yeah, I'm sure that there's some amazing lore in the item description about why a ball suddenly killed me out of nowhere, or why this stone giant is stomping around this one specific area. But a lot of the time, it feels like they thought of something cool and just put it into the game. But the game's unpredictability is often a strength. The story, it has one. Apparently George R.R. Martin collaborated with this game, but it's hard to see his mark. A lot of characters have very similar names, so maybe that is a Gurm influence. It really does feel like a story From themselves made up. It's filled with strange and woeful characters. I gotta say, I hope the Dung Eater would be far more friendlier than he is. The background lore is pretty interesting, but it's something I'm going to engage with more via YouTube lore videos than what the game is presenting me. I'm about 20 hours in and in the third Legacy Dungeon, but I think it's safe to say that this will be my favorite From Software title. They've crafted a wonderfully weird open world with a tremendous amount of freedom. It's fun to just go and look at things, even though most of these things will slaughter you. With Arceus and now Elden Ring, 2022 has given us two games with unique philosophies on the open world formula, and both are tremendously refreshing. It might be unfair to say From Software should only make Elden Ring type of games, only games with this type of scope, but it certainly is hard to go back to the more linear style Souls games after experiencing this. I'm really excited to see how they build on the formula in future Elden Ring games, or maybe even new franchises. Maybe an open world Sekiro, think about that. Let's throw a non-Japanese game in here as well. Well, the developer is not Japanese, but maybe the series is? I checked out Cruisin' Blast earlier this year. It's another entry in the Cruisin' franchise, a series that has been pretty dormant for a long time. You know those dormant franchises that have diehard fans that just wish for a reboot, port, remake, anything? I'm not sure if Cruisin' is one of those. It's definitely got an odd history. It started off in the arcades in 1994 with Cruisin' USA from Midway. If you didn't play the arcade version, you may have played the home version, as it was quite a notable title on the N64. It was followed by World and Exotica on the hardware, but really the peak in terms of interest was the very first game. It was one of those franchises that looked great, but it got pretty middling reviews. Even then, it was still pretty popular. Then there was Cruisin' Velocity, a GBA game. It came back to home consoles with a game simply called Cruisin' for Wii. And weirdly enough, this game is actually based on a Fast and Furious arcade game, but with all the licensing stripped out. So no Vin Diesel. It was released by Raw Thrills, founded by Eugene Jarvis, who helped create the franchise for Midway. Raw Thrills has followed that game up after nearly a decade with Cruisin' Blast, which released in arcades in 2017 and the Switch in 2021. Bringing it back to Japan, Cruisin' Blast actually does have a Japanese release, even though the past titles didn't. If I'm not mistaken, this is the first home release of Cruisin' in Japan. The N64 titles never came out over here. There are actually quite a few notable N64 games that never came out in Japan, and vice versa. Seems like a good feature, Now, why is this franchise important at all? Well, it's technically a Nintendo franchise. I looked into the history, and I'm not quite sure about the semantics of it, but it was obviously created by Midway, yet it was published by Nintendo on home hardware. Now that there's no Midway, it seems that Nintendo got complete control of Cruisin' somehow. I've been looking online for the details, but all I can find is that Nintendo just somehow owns Cruisin'. Not exactly a high-profile franchise, as they didn't create it from scratch, but they have it nonetheless. They licensed it to Raw Thrills for the creation of Cruisin' Blast, so this is actually a console exclusive for Nintendo. While the original Cruisin' games mixed realism with arcade racing, this title is highly emphasizing the arcade part and not the realism. Obviously, there are real cars, like actual Nissan models, but you race against made-up fantasy cars and more bizarre vehicles like helicopters, UFOs, and even dinosaurs. It goes all in on the color, the neon, the wackiness. This is much more Mario Kart than Gran Turismo, but it also has its own very distinct style and gameplay. The game has your attention from second one. It starts off with a very cheesy theme song with a woman belting out the name of the game. I can't lie, this is the best part of the game. Not to say that the rest is bad, but this is clearly the best part. The controls are very simple. Gas, brake, drift, boost. Winning is really all about timing your boosts effectively. The structure of the races is pretty odd in that your opponents really don't seem to race realistically. For example, if you go into a race and boost three times back to back, your opponents will follow you neck and neck. It's not like Mario Kart where you can get a clear lead on the other racers. In Cruisin' Blast, the other racers magically match you lap for lap. A lot of races are won by timing your boost right at the end. This certainly makes races more exciting as it comes down to nail-biting finishes, but it also feels a bit phony. I can see why it's implemented in an arcade game that is supposed to cheat and take your quarters, but it does feel odd on a home console. Boosting, or blasting as they like to call it, is the most important element when racing. You can bring consumable boosts into the race, but it's also important to consistently hit the speed ramp scattered throughout the track. If you're just driving a car normally, something has gone wrong. You can also do a lot of wacky tricks when you're in the air, like 360 spins and backflips. Yes, cars can backflip. The animations are quick and janky, but also charming. The game is fully aware of what it is. It wants to be silly, it wants to make you laugh, and wants to thrill you with its antics. The real appeal of the game is how fast and crazy it can get. While a lot of stages are based on real locations, it's an incredibly exaggerated and goofy version of it. And there are stages where you are racing between dinosaurs or through an alien invasion. So many of these are completely bizarre that you can't help but laugh. In one stage, you make this massive jump where you are hundreds of feet in the air, and then suddenly the surface collapses and you race underground. Another has you landing on a speeding train after a huge jump or smashing into cop cars. There's certainly a lot of unexpected scenarios that make races feel fresh, even though many of them have pretty simplistic layouts. There's a lot of flash and style here. While the graphics aren't the best, they certainly have a very vibrant and glossy look. Cruisin' Blast is obviously designed to catch your eye as you pass it in an arcade. You can really tell it's based off of an arcade game. This is not a game packed with a lot of new content or modes to satiate the home audience. There are some new cars and tracks for the Switch version for sure, but otherwise there's not a whole lot to do outside of tours where you vie for first place after blasting down four tracks and local multiplayer. Online multiplayer is apparently coming, but it hasn't been added to the game yet. In terms of unlockables, there is an extra section that sort of serves as an achievement record, but it's really your typical stuff like win 10 races with X car and whatnot. Really, the meat of the game is going through the single player mode and getting the gold medal on all the tracks and difficulties. You earn money through races, which you can use to level up your car, to give it better stats, or add some really gaudy cosmetics to it. Each track also has three hidden keys, which you would need to unlock some vehicles. I recommend the UFO for sure. It's huge and yeah, it's a UFO. It was $40 at launch, but the price has permanently dropped to $20. Though even at $20, it's kind of hard to recommend. I had fun playing it and seeing all the levels for the first time, but a lot of tracks are very similar or reskins, and the strength of the tracks aren't due to their brilliant design, but because of the wacky things that happen in the background. Once you see all the jokes and get used to the insanity, the tracks are a little dry in terms of actual gameplay. I cleared all the races in about 2 hours, and I don't have a huge desire to ace them all on higher difficulties. I do want to pick it back up once they add online just to see how it fares as a multiplayer title. That's all for games this time. Now for some news. Pokemon! shock news. And the thing I want to talk about most, of course, Pokemon Scarlet and Violet, the newest generation of Pokemon. Gen 9, wow. It was announced on Pokemon Day, which was also the last episode of this podcast. I did a bit of speculation, but sadly, I didn't say anything about Gen 9. But if you go back and listen to my Nintendo Switch 2022 preview, I did say that Gen 9 was probable for this year. So give me a quarter of a point at least. Pokemon Scarlet and Violet, late 2022, Game Freak. I keep wanting to say Pokemon Violet. Just call it Pokemon Purple, it's more fun to say. It's described as an open-world Pokemon game. Yes, open world. Towns blend seamlessly into the world without borders. This is exactly what I want, and it's hard to believe that we're getting it so quickly after Arceus. It seemed that Game Freak dipped its toes into the open-world concept with the wild areas in Sword and Shield. They went waist-deep with Arceus, but now they're all in with Gen 9. I really enjoyed Arceus, and like I said this very episode, I think it had a fresh take on the open-world concept, even though it wasn't technically an open-world game. So I am very excited to see what Game Freak does with a full open-world title. I still think that it will be fairly structured. I'm not sure you can just go to whatever town you want and do gyms out of order, but I am expecting a good deal of freedom here. In Arceus, you could find yourself in situations where you were completely outmatched, areas that felt like you weren't supposed to be there. I'm hoping for the same in SV. I want to be able to push my luck and explore places way before I'm supposed to, and all the risks that come with that. There is so much potential for an open-world Pokemon game if they don't mind taking the training wheels off. Will they keep the more action-oriented traversal options from Arceus? They didn't show anybody diving or sneaking, so it might be more limiting in your actions. I think we will certainly have ride Pokemon at the very least. Nailing traversal is an important part of making a good open-world game. Zelda, of course, is a master of this, and Arceus mimicked it, but I am very curious to see if this game is going to be an evolution of the concepts from Arceus or something completely different. One thing that seems different from Arceus is that there likely won't be any throwing or instant catch mechanics. The website states, quote, battling against wild Pokemon in order to catch them, meaning you won't be able to just hurl a Pokeball for an instant catch. Even if that mechanic isn't in, I want them to keep the overall throwing aspect of the game, like being able to start a battle with a specific Pokemon by tossing it out, and throwing bait in your Pokemon to get its attention. If it is just like Sword and Shield, where they kind of aimlessly wander around, mostly ignoring you, I'll be disappointed. Arceus captured the feeling of seeing Pokemon in their natural environment, and I think that's an important element to keep in the future. I can go all day speculating about the open world structure, but we honestly don't know a whole lot yet. Surprise me, Game Freak. We got a short trailer showcasing the newest region. It seems like it's heavily based on Spain and the Iberian Peninsula in general. So we will be sticking with Europe. Pretty crazy to think that we've had three whole generations based in Europe. Nearly 10 years. Turns out they've got a lot of culture over there. I've never been to Spain, so I can't give fun tidbits about it, but it's a fresh location for Pokemon and really a game in general. I mean, how many games take place in Spain? We have some nice locales like villas, windmills, and a very Disneyland-esque city that seems like it might be a major hub area of the game. Put a Pokeball on a castle. It's an evocative image every single time. We also see a lot of biomes like a beach, grasslands, and even a desert, which is something we didn't see in Arceus. There's also a sneak peek of some Pokemon that will pop up. Larvitar shows up, and that got me excited. Perhaps the most interesting is a Hisuian Zora arc, which is supposed to be extinct, right? What are you doing here? We don't have the name of the region, but I'm sure we will get regional forms. Ironically, we saw a normal Meowth, a mon that had regional forms in the past, but not this time. And we also got to see the starters. Sprigatito, a plucky grass cat. Fuecoco, a plump fire alligator. Quaxly, a stylish water duck. Their names in Japanese are Nyoha, Hogeita, and Kuwasu, just FYI. I think all of these are incredibly strong designs. If we're going from a pure design aspect, I think this is the best overall batch since Gen 4. Gen 5 and beyond have strong starters for sure, but there's always one or two in each gen that doesn't hit with me. But this time I feel that all of them look spectacular. If I had to pick, I gotta go with Fuecoco. I'm normally a grass starter guy, but he's a cool looking pepper alligator. I thought he was an apple at first, but yeah, a pepper makes way more sense. Apparently he resembles a popular tapa, but let's not get into the whole eating Pokemon thing. Though we gotta brace for their final evolutions. Will Sprigatito stand up? Will Quaxly's evolution look so cool that we'll have no choice but to pick it? I'm hoping Fue Coco stays the course and looks rad the entire game. This is going to be a massive holiday title for the Switch. They said late 2022, but if you look at the past games, they've released around October and November, typically before Black Friday. I suspect Scarlet and Violet will release around the same time. This year already looked stacked from January 1st, yet we are still getting huge game announcements. 2022 is easily going to go down as one of the biggest years in terms of Nintendo software. Let's stay in the Pokemon world a bit longer. The newest Pokemon TCG expansion was announced for Japan, Time Gazer and Space Juggler. Time Gazer, I guess people gaze at time, metaphorically. Space Juggler, are people juggling space? What does that mean? This expansion focuses on the origin forms of Dialga and Palkia, plus it will have trainer cards focusing on the Diamond and Pearl clans from Legends Arceus. There will be at least two new V-Star cards as well. I picked up some Battle Legion packs recently, and while I didn't get any Hisuian starters, I definitely pulled some fun cards like Cleaver and Starmie V. I occasionally open up packs on my Instagram, so check it out. It's March, and this means it's Kirby's month. I'm going to have a Kirby-related feature next episode, so please look forward to that. In the meantime, you can own a special Kirby Nintendo Switch OLED by getting it off of Nintendo's official Japanese shop. And by Kirby OLED, I mean it comes with a special box. Imagine if Kirby went mouthful mode on an OLED box. It's basically just a rectangular pink Kirby box. But isn't that what we all want? Sadly, you can't buy the box separately, but it might be possible in the future. In Japan, they actually sold empty Splatoon 2 Nintendo Switch boxes because people wanted to rehouse their Switch. So I am hoping they do the same for the Kirby box. Advance Wars 1 and 2 Reboot Camp got delayed. Again. This is the second time an Advance Wars delay has popped up in this new section. It was originally slated for December, then got pushed to April 8th. Now it'll be released at an unknown moment of time. Nintendo cited that it was delayed due to the ongoing attacks on the Ukraine. I definitely saw some speculation that it would be delayed, and that some people said that a war game with tanks might not be the best thing to release these days, and Nintendo followed through. It's unfortunate to see this title get delayed again, but it's understandable. The series has terrible luck with release dates. The original game hit September 10th, 2001. When will this remake actually come out? Who knows? It was less than a month away from release, so you have to think that retailers or inventory warehouses already have the game. May is pretty empty in terms of first-party Nintendo releases, so you could move it to the end of May, though it's hard to say if the situation will improve by then or ever. August is another likely release date. Nintendo Switch Sports is still slated for April, so they aren't hurting on new game releases, but hopefully Advance Wars finds a release date where it won't get buried. Sony had a Japan-focused state of play, a Nintendo Direct. There's definitely a few notable announcements for Switch owners. My favorite was the TMNT Kawabunga Collection, which packs in 13 classic Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles games from Konami. Now, these are not necessarily 13 wildly different games. Many of them are console or arcade variations. The collection includes the original arcade game and its variants, the three NES games, Turtles in Time and its ports, Hyperstone Heist, three versions of Tournament Fighters, and the three Game Boy titles. The Japanese and US versions are included. Ironically, Turtles in Time Arcade and NES Tournament Fighters did not have Japanese releases, but the English versions will be included in the Japanese release. The standouts to me are, of course, Turtles in Time and the original arcade game. The original NES game was very popular, but also infamous for its difficulty. Digital Eclipse is handling this collection, which means it comes with the Save Anywhere functions and a rewind, which is probably incredibly vital for those NES games. I'm thrilled these collections are seeing the light of day, but like I talked about last week with the Capcom Fighting Collection, it's not like I want to play every game here. It's also pretty odd that it's releasing at least relatively close to the upcoming TMNT Beat'em-Up. You could technically own 14 different Turtles games this year alone. No date yet, but it's coming to everything. Also coming to everything is JoJo's Bizarre Adventure All-Star Battle R, a remaster of the original game on the PS3. I'm not a JoJo expert at all, but it's got 50 characters. I don't think that's all of them, but that's a pretty big number regardless. I mostly know about this game because the original title got a perfect score from Famitsu. Once upon a time, games that got all 10s in Famitsu were heralded as the second coming. It's a magazine that has been around since the 80s, but the first game to get a perfect score was Ocarina of Time. Deserving. The second one was Soul Calibur. Also deserving. Then Vagrant Story. Okay, that game certainly has its fans. But as time went on, the rare perfect score went from almost never happening to getting dished out all the time. To me, JoJo getting it was really at the breaking point where I thought, okay, they're just giving it out to whatever now. Fun fact, the most recent game to get a perfect score from Famitsu was Ghost of Tsushima. Another big also coming to Switch title is the Deal Field Chronicle, yet another tactics game from Square Enix. Some people were like, again? But hey, crank these out. I'll buy them. It's being co-developed by Lancars, who recently worked on the JRPG Monarch. The game forgoes the holy tiles of most SRPGs and is more like XCOM, where you move in a field of range. Can't get a good feel on the story. It's fantasy, there are kingdoms, you know, typical war stuff. But give me a party, give me tactics, and I'm in. It's coming out this year, so add it on the huge pile of strategy games coming to Switch in 2022. There are some noteworthy non-Switch games shown. Capcom showed off not Dino Crisis, Exo Primal, which is a multiplayer shooter where you battle hordes of dinosaurs. It looks very silly, but also fun. Though, do people want to fight dinosaurs? I always thought people wanted to team up with dinosaurs, but maybe I'm just too pro-dinosaur. Square, not to be outdone by anyone, announced yet another game, Valkyrie Elysium. It's an action game in the Valkyrie series. Remember Valkyrie Profile? It's that. It's a franchise I'm not really familiar with, but I'm glad that Square actually does put in effort to put out new entries, or at least remasters, of more obscure titles. In general, the state of plays have been pretty lackluster. I mean, there are good announcements, but it's by no means the quality or spectacle of a Nintendo Direct. Nintendo is a company that relies far more on first-party games for their console, so it's much easier to keep it close to the chest and then announce everything at once, unlike Sony. But hey, there are games coming out that I want to play, so I'm happy. Let's wrap up with some Japanese sales. Switch hardware is still cleaning house, at 170,000 units sold these past 2 weeks in Japan. So far, it has the second highest year to date, only trailing behind the explosive opening from last year. PS5 has sold 45,000 units these past 2 weeks, a bit up from last year. Again, the same old story. Stock issues are hurting its performance in Japan. PlayStation does have some big titles in the early part of this year, so we should see software push hardware sales. Another big winner these past 2 weeks has been Elden Ring, which has sold around 350,000 physical units in Japan, most of these being the PS4 version. Although the PS5 version sold pretty close to its counterpart the first week, it had a bigger drop in week 2. Even then, Elden Ring is the first PS5 game to sell over 100,000 units physically in Japan. Triangle Strategy debuted at the number one spot this past week with 86,000 units. I expected a bit more, but with digital, it seemed to have a good launch. Gran Turismo 7 was the real number one if you combine the SKUs, at over 130,000 units. The PS5 actually outsold the PS4 version in week 1. When you have a series like GT that demands the cutting-edge graphics, you really don't want to cheap out on last-gen's version. This is the first time a PS5 version has outsold the PS4 version in Japan, so that shift is happening sooner than later. COVID and the slow adoption of PS5 in Japan has certainly forced cross-gen titles much later than expected. There will be cross-gen titles in 2023, 10 years after the PS4 released. We have Strangers in Paradise and Kirby coming up, so those should be some fun numbers to look at. I'm expecting huge numbers for Kirby. It's got to be the best-selling Kirby game ever, an easy 5 million in my mind. I feel people who normally ignore the franchise are going to give this one a shot. It may not be Mario Odyssey tier, but it should be a fun time. Let's start wrapping up with the Japanese gaming phrase of the week. I wanted to find out what the Japanese word of Souls-like is, and turns out it's Souls-like. That's no fun. This week's phrase is Unzen Chitai. Unzen Chitai. It literally translates to safe zone. It refers to an area in a game that you cannot get damaged, either through a glitch or perhaps purposely put into the game for strategic reasons. It's also known as Anchi for short. I'm sure there are some Anchi areas in Souls games that people like to take advantage of, so it kind of fits for this week. Again, Unzen Chitai. Now for the Japanese tweet of the week. I've chosen one from @heat_maroon, a game collector. This tweet shows off his collection of every single PS1 game. I'm not sure if this includes only Japanese games or if international titles are there as well, but he has an overwhelming amount of PS1 games. It's incredible to see how many bookshelves these games take up, despite the fact that PS1 was pretty well known for its compact CD cases. If you want to be jealous, be sure to check it out. As always, the tweet is in the podcast description. That's all this time around. Thanks as always for listening. Be sure to like and subscribe to this podcast on your favorite app. This podcast is also available on YouTube, so like and subscribe there as well. I'm on Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok. Just search for Tokyo Game Life or find the links in the podcast description. If you like the podcast, be sure to share it with your friends. If there's anything you want me to talk about or cover, don't be shy. just hit me up on social media. The next episode will be Sunday, March 27th. Until then, chill out and play some video games. See you next time. Matane!